Bonjour and welcome to Bon Appetit on Sun Sounds of Arizona. The August 2025 issue highlights the food of Hawaii, starting with Hawaii the Local Way by Elise Inamine. This chain of volcanic islands spanning 1,500 miles of the Pacific Ocean is an ecological wonder. Those who call Hawaii home also know of a different bounty, a highly unique culinary tradition as lush and enticing as the landscape itself. Whenever I'm in Hawaii, I go quiet. In wondrous silence, I take in field after field of heart-shaped kalo leaves as they wave in the wind, rocky shorelines teeming with bright green manes of limu'alele, or the radiating shells of opihi, and at 3 a.m., when the crowds and sun are gone, the glowing red spurts of an erupting volcano. I heed the advice of aunties and uncles who tell me the best place to get tender kalua pork, and don't ever take a lava rock, because they did it once and learned their lesson. As it was when I was a child, everywhere I go, I hear the sign of a good meal, routine as sudden bursts of warm rain, loud slurps of semon, a noodle soup inspired by ramen, pancit, and chow mein. Not quite a tourist, not quite a local, my connection to this archipelago of 8 distinctive islands of the Pacific is through my father's side on Oahu, whom I've visited nearly every year since I was little. Growing up, I learned about Hawaii through osmosis, as I was shuttled from relatives' homes and church lunches to secret to us beaches. But once I started writing about food, I wanted to fill in the blanks of the place I had come to love. I sought out chefs, food historians, educators, and farmers, and they invited me to clean fish ponds, pick fiddlehead ferns, and listen. Today I remain quiet as I return to the islands often, and I learn more with each trip, each person who talks story. They graciously show me the Hawaii they know through a language we all share, food. The culinary tradition of Hawaii is just as varied and rich as the terrain. It's more than spam musubi. It's a reflection of the people who have come to call this place home. It begins with native Hawaiians, known as Kanaka Maoli, or the True People, who introduced ingredients, cooking techniques, and dishes now emblematic of the islands, poke, poi, laulau cooked underground in an imbu, and stewarded the aina, land, treating it as an elder sibling. And it has expanded with each new inhabitant, welcome or not, from Western colonizers to Asian, European, and Puerto Rican sugarcane plantation workers to the U.S. military. These outside forces have led to a vivid yet complicated culinary identity that defies categorization. There's local food, not to be confused with Hawaiian food, a mashup of cultural cuisines seen in dishes like huli huli chicken, a Portuguese riff on Japanese teriyaki, or restaurants like Kyung Seafood, which serves mac salad as Korean banchan, spicy tuna poke, kalbi, and rice. Simultaneously, through this influx of change, farmers, scholars, and chefs continue to preserve sovereign native Hawaiian traditions despite decades of erosion. Their practices and values live on in restoring ancient ahupua'a, a connective land management system, in laymaking, and in feeding each generation. The stories that follow explore these ideas. Chefs share the recipes that embody their upbringing on the islands, showing how a simple sweet mango bread or grilled pork belly dinakticin, unlike anything made in the Philippines, can break down borders and broaden them. Renowned Hawaiian writers delve into the clingy limpets or amethyst-hued sweet potatoes harvested from the water and land that have shaped their identities. What is local food exactly? Local food in Hawaii is a genre-bending, border-blurring cuisine, a result of the constant cultural exchange among numerous immigrant communities unique to the islands. Think sukiyaki-inspired chicken heka or sugar-encrusted Portuguese malasadas filled with liliko, passion fruit, cream. Chefs born and raised here, like Sheldon Simeon or Robin Molly, grew up eating these kinds of dishes. Their generation is leading a new wave of local food that stretches familiar flavors and ideas even further. For Simeon, that means Chinese-style dry aging and oven roasting huli huli chicken, while at Mai Yi Seasonal Bakery, Mi Ye Fet, elegant layer cakes are infused with POG, passion fruit orange, and guava. With each riff, local food continues its legacy of reflecting how locals cook and share. All of it is ono, the Hawaiian word for delicious. Chef Sheldon Simeon says, "Our dishes shift with us." Dinagdakan comes from the northern region of the Philippines, where most Filipino families in Hawaii originally emigrated from. Over time, the dish has become more inspired by Hawaii. We're surrounded by every culture that uses soy sauce, so that's now part of the marinade, along with vinegar, garlic, and bay leaf. Sometimes I'll add shishito peppers to the grill for a little heat. Our local food is a dialogue between cultures, and we celebrate that, the opihi of the family. For author Megan Kamalele Kakmoto, the limpet with a sticky reputation symbolizes maternal longing. The summer I turned 13, my Hawaiian ohana gathered at Kaiawea, an eroded beach on the south shore of Molokai, to celebrate a distant cousin's graduation. Scanning the sands for a familiar face, I thought achingly of my mother, still on Oahu, separated by 50 miles of Kaiwi Channel. I caught the gaze of a different cousin, with pockmarked cheeks and unruly eyebrows, whom I'd met that morning. He extended a plastic bag filled with conical opihi shells, redolent of brine and algae. "Like chai?" he asked. "She no like," said another cousin or uncle. "She's one chicken." While they weren't wrong, their judgment only emboldened my resolve. I was stubborn and starving and missing my mother terribly. I was there for my grams, a spitfire Hawaiian, who'd insisted she host her grandchildren for the week on Molokai. Her roots were in Kamau, our Kuliwi, the land holding the bones of our ancestors. Without my mother, though, Molokai did not feel like homeland, but a humid, inhospitable place. This impression wasn't a reflection of the island, but of myself. Back then, my family would tease me, "Mama's opihi," the opihi of the family. The limpets cling to shoreline rocks in Hawaii's rough intertidal zones, found in clusters, never alone. I peered at them wet and slimy, some shells beige, others almost golden. I wished to be brighter and louder, to consume something that shone. I wished to be independent and to fit in with my Hawaiian side as seamlessly as my sister and cousins. So I plucked a creature at random, slurped from the shell, and chewed. The meat's rubbery yet snappy texture resisted my efforts. I tried very hard not to grimace. "Pihi," my cousin explained, "or ono when grilled or raw and doused in Tabasco." He showed me the scars on his forearms, evidence of years of opihi picking in the rocky, wave-battered terrain. I wanted to show him I was a true Hawaiian, like the rest of my ohana, with a true Hawaiian appetite. The bottom had fallen out from my desire, for belonging, for my mother. My knees were bottomless. I reached for a second helping, but my cousin drew the bag away. "Gotta make sure everyone get their fill." Sense of place. That's S-C-E-N-T-S. Scholar and translator D. Kawila Ma details how lei are linked to native Hawaiian food, land, and identity. For Kanaka Ma'ole, lei represent our foodways and aina, land, intimately tying us to sense and sense of place. Due to industrial sugarcane and pineapple monocropping and a historic lack of indigenous agricultural autonomy, our once plentiful endemic plants are now under threat. Pockets of Hawaii food deserts are prevalent throughout the islands. Some native flora are extinct, enduring only in mele, chants, and songs. Thankfully, many lei, medicine, and hula practitioners are making strides to revitalize our native plant species, judiciously harvesting or replanting in public and private spaces, from the mountains to home gardens, leading classes with their knowledge and incorporating lei making into their daily lives. There are countless iterations of lei, several specific to each of Hawaii's islands. They do not resemble the orchid rings tourists often mistake for Hawaiian tradition in the same way Waikiki Luau performances and tiki culture do not capture a true sense of home. Instead, lei represent our delicate food genealogies and fragrant flora as told in our oral histories. The power of poke. Sam Choi is a founding member of the groundbreaking Hawaiian regional cuisine movement, the second native Hawaiian chef to win a James Beard Award, and the godfather of poke. Here he shares how far the iconic raw fish dish has come and where he sees it going. As told to Elise Inamine, I was 7 or 8 years old, a kid hanging out with a fisherman at Hukilau Beach when I had my first taste. This guy squished up some raw fish in his hand, dunked it in the ocean water, and put it in my mouth. I never forgot it. The freshness of the fish, the saltiness of water giving it just enough flavor. Since that day, poke is how I see the world. In the mid-80s, I had this popular dish in Rotterdam, a big bowl of herring with minced white onions that you eat raw. When I tried it, I went, God, this is poke. I tasted in pickled crawfish tail meat at a Louisiana boil, in South American ceviche, and well, of course, everywhere in Japan. Eating that herring, I realized that every cuisine has a little resemblance to my upbringing. In Hawaii, the dish has historically been pre-Captain Cook poke, so pre-1778. Raw fish seasoned with sea salt, inomona, nutty roasted kukui, and libu, or as I like to call it, sea salad. But as different ethnic groups came here to work on sugarcane and pineapple plantations, they brought their food with them, which brought something to poke. I make mine the same way, collaboratively. I'm like a kid in a candy store, trying vegan versions with ulu and sweet potatoes, or using sustainable fish, like farm-raised Ora King salmon. Today, poke has made it to the big dance. You can find shops and chipotle-like counters in Dubai, Paris, all over the continental U.S. I'm not upset about it. I'm thankful because the love for it is growing. My parents taught me that whenever you've got something good, don't hold it, share it. That's what I've been doing. Everywhere I go, I make poke. And when I do, I watch people's faces light up. It's a taste they'll never forget, and they'll go hunt for it too, just like I have. Every home in Hawaii has a snack table for anyone who shows up. Inevitably, there are snacking cakes, like mango bread. The following recipe is made with ripe mangoes, which go off in Hawaii late spring into summer. I love this recipe because it's delicious and so forgiving, anyone can make it, but also because it's a baked good that's truly local. You can't trace Filipino roots or say it's Korean. It belongs to everyone. Robin Mai, mango bread, 8 to 10 servings. This mango bread is adapted from Mai's maternal grandmother's neighbor, Mrs. Furusho's recipe. They shared a flowering hedge and a fondness for mangoes, of which there are plenty in Hawaii. Think of mango bread as similar to banana bread, with the same tender, ultra-moist texture, but with a golden hue from the mangoes. If you can find very ripe, juicy mangoes near you, use them instead of the frozen called for in the recipe. You'll need 1 to 2 mangoes, depending on the size of the variety you use, to get 1.5 cups. Bread. Nonstick vegetable oil spray for pan. 2 cups, 250 grams, all-purpose flour. 1 teaspoon Diamond Crystal or 1/2 teaspoon Morton kosher salt, 1/2 teaspoon baking powder, 1/4 teaspoon baking soda, 1/4 teaspoon freshly grated nutmeg, 8 ounces frozen mango chunks, thawed, about 1.5 cups, 3 large eggs, zest of 1 lime, 1.5 cups, 300 grams granulated sugar, 1/2 cup, 1 stick, unsalted butter, melted, slightly cooled. 1/4 cup vegetable oil. 1 tablespoon vanilla extract. Glaze and assembly. 2 tablespoons unsalted butter, melted, slightly cooled. 1 tablespoon fresh lime juice, kosher salt. 1.5 cups, 165 grams or more, powdered sugar. Thin strips of lime zest for topping, optional. Bread. Place a rack in middle of oven and preheat to 325 degrees. Lightly coat a 9x5 loaf pan with cooking spray. Line with parchment paper, leaving overhang on long sides. Whisk flour, salt, baking powder, baking soda, and nutmeg in a medium bowl to combine. Set aside. Blend mango, including any juices, in a blender until very smooth. Transfer 1 tablespoon mango puree to a medium bowl and set aside for making the glaze. Add eggs, lime zest, granulated sugar, butter, oil, and vanilla to remaining puree in blender. Blend until smooth. Pour into bowl with reserved dry ingredients and stir gently with a whisk or rubber spatula until no large dry streaks of flour remain. Some small lumps are okay. Scrape batter into prepared pan and place on a small rimmed baking sheet. Bake bread until golden brown and top springs back when gently pressed in the center, 40 to 50 minutes. Transfer pan to a wire rack set inside a rimmed baking sheet. Let bread cool in pan 20 minutes. Turn bread out onto rack, peel away parchment and discard. Let cool completely. Glaze and assembly. Add butter, lime juice, and a large pinch of salt to bowl with reserved mango puree. Whisk to combine. Sift powdered sugar over and whisk until a thick glaze forms. It should quickly coat a spoon. If runny, add more sifted powdered sugar, 2 tablespoons at a time, until you reach desired consistency. Pour glaze over bread. For a flat finish, glaze bottom of loaf, letting it run down sides. Scatter lime strips, if using, over glaze while still wet. Let sit until glaze is set, at least 45 minutes. Now I'll be reading a piece titled On Being Hawaiian. Author T. Kira Mahilani Madden wanted to connect with her heritage by moving to ancestral land. The fruit farm she lived on provided so much more. The first morning I woke up on the Wi'ani fruit farm, our host Chris, a hardscrabble, brilliant woman who immigrated from China, walked me through her yard to meet every tree. All this bounty, she gestured around her 3 acres of land, is for my dogs. Some of the trees were native, others introduced by migrant communities. Like the components of a Hawaiian plate lunch, every plant on Chris's farm told the story of the island's diverse history. We carried baskets, and she showed me how to check for ripeness by color, feel, smell. We tore open fruits with our bare hands, touching the flesh inside. Eat this, she said, tossing me a spiky soursop. I scooped with my fingers and ate it, the perky sourness true to its name. Then Chris handed me an ulu, otherwise known as breadfruit. I held the alien globe, knocked on its vibrant green dinosaur skin. What is it? I asked. Aren't you a Hawaiian? Chris said. A Hawaiian should know this. Later that night, as I sliced into the ulu and found its flesh dappled with thousands of tiny holes, I threw the fruit away from me and texted my mother. Trypophobia triggered. I think I just felt the indigenous leave my body. My mother, like so many Kanaka Maoli, was displaced from the Aina before I was born. She raised me on Seminole land in South Florida. Most stories of displacement are the same. Cost of living, cost of survival, the cultural push to move over to the mainland to Americanize after the illegal overthrow and statehood of our islands. My mother is of the generation banned by the United States from speaking our native language. Olalo Hawaii. I had my high school graduation at a Polynesian-themed restaurant called the Maikai in Fort Lauderdale. Plastic lay festooning the tables. Which is to say, I was looking for something when I was offered a job at University of Hawaii Manoa, a one-semester stint as their distinguished writer and teacher-in-residence. I'd never lived on Ina, and from my laptop screen in Massachusetts, I zoomed in on the fruit farm, located on the leeward coast of Oahu, over an hour drive from the resorts of the Waikiki Strip. Chris's rental was also a block from the Lualualai Hawaiian Homestead, one of several areas assigned back to Native Hawaiians as homelands by the U.S. government, where my own ohana had once lived. When we finally arrived in our oil-leaking pickup truck, my wife, Hannah, and I drove past the encampments of houseless kanaka, shipping containers with sleeping bags inside, bubble-rusted refrigerators dumped beside the homestead roads. Rooster roadkill fluttered along the most beautiful coastline in the world. I wondered if being here would finally bring me closer to feeling like an actual Hawaiian. Here are some other things I thought I had to do to feel more Hawaiian. Confirm my blood quantum percentage via DNA kit. Hire translators to interpret my family's land Kuleana paperwork and letters. Obtain a shiny red Office of Hawaiian Affairs, OHA, card with my picture on it that might whisper from my wallet, "Yes, you are enough." Our first month on the farm, I spent my days in Honolulu's state archives, buried in hulking books, and in the evenings, I squeezed tart caviar of finger limes from the yard, fermented calamansi in chilies, pickled waxy bilimbi in jars of brown sugar, a crisp secret ingredient to add to any soup. Every night, a Buddha's hand martini. At all hours, mangoes dropped and smacked our pickup, setting off the alarm. I did this because I was curious, of course, but also because shopping at the grocery store in Waianae proved impossible on a teacher's salary. It cost over $20 to make box spaghetti with canned sauce in the area where the majority of Kanaka Maoli on Oahu live. So I accepted every vegetable Chris gave us gratefully. I accepted the whole fish her partner caught off the piers in the early mornings, which she'd place in my hand as I drank coffee on the deck. I'd pack boxes of Nature Valley granola bars in my suitcase and use them in place of expensive flour, which made for a better fish fry. With every bite of food, I began to wonder if the right taste would somehow correct my posture, send a buzz through my scalp, something ancestral saying, "This is what you are." Here's what actually made me feel more Hawaiian. Speaking to the ocean, learning to oli, chant, asking questions of Mauna Leo, native speakers, digging my hands into the darkest soil for lo'i, taro patch, restoration. Each experience a distinct privilege. I enrolled in Olelo Hawaii classes and started translating my ohana's documents and letters too, working my mouth around new vowels and glottal stops. One day, under a crescent kukolu moon, I asked Chris to teach me to make charcoal. This was part of her weekly routine, collecting branches and coconut husks. Kiawe wood smoldering black to gray to white. She showed me how to move the wood with giant tongs to a bucket full of water. And then it's the hiss in your ears, the wood bobbing to the surface, unbelievably light. I smoked pineapple, ulu, eggplant, amber speckled eggs. But there was something different about the sweet potatoes, uala. I broke them open, still steaming from the grill. They looked like toy amethysts, talismans that might save a princess, a king, striated purple, glowing from the inside. I ate them like apples, bite after bite. Then I chopped them, zested calamansi and Buddha's hand, added mayo, sprinkled herbs from the yard. No photo or description could do it justice, not even with sunlight pooling in the bowl as I took a picture to send to my mom, not even with the English words I knew, the olelo words I was learning. The simplicity of eating potatoes barefoot on Waianae, the horizon a gold thread, the color of na'u seed as the birds paid their nightly visit, somehow its own answer. Here's when I felt true belonging. Once I could loosely translate my family documents, I traveled to Waipio Valley on Moku Kiawe, Big Island. The goal? To finally visit my ancestors' Kuleana plot, the place they'd lived and survived for generations before moving to Oahu's homesteads. I wouldn't learn until that trip what our land smelled like. Wouldn't know until hopping fences, trespassing, onto the plot upon which a purple mansion now sits, what it meant to meet my ancestors in the wind, to speak to them in Olelo, Hawaii. I found what I needed under the ulu trees that bordered my ohana's land. When a Hawaiian asks one to introduce oneself, they are not interested in an OHA card. They are asking, who are your waters, your mountain, your wind? What food sustained your people? My Aina is the Waipio Valley of the Kingdom of Hawaii, our rain, the furrowed rain called Wa'awahia. I carried my Ohana's letters with me on the journey. 1 year prior, I'd missed the details that mattered. Now I read them again, took my time. In my late uncle's cursive, the food of our Ohana was the uala, the humble sweet potato. Here is a recipe for grilled purple sweet potato salad, which yields 4 servings. This grilled purple sweet potato salad, inspired by Madden's Farm Stay in Hawaii, is smoky and nutty with blistered potatoes and a mayo-based dressing punched up with toasted sesame seeds and plenty of lemon. Purple sweet potatoes bring the most dramatic color, but regular orange ones are just as exceptional. 2 pounds purple sweet potatoes, peeled. 1 teaspoon Diamond Crystal or 1/4 teaspoon Morton Kosher salt plus more. 1 tablespoon white sesame seeds plus more for serving. 1 garlic clove finely grated. 1/2 cup mayonnaise. 1 tablespoon finely grated lemon zest. 2 tablespoons fresh lemon juice. 1 tablespoon soy sauce. 1 teaspoon freshly ground pepper. 1 teaspoon sugar. 1 teaspoon toasted sesame oil, 2 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, thinly sliced scallions for serving. Place sweet potatoes in a large pot and pour in water to cover. Season with salt and bring to a simmer. Cook until almost tender, 18 to 25 minutes. Drain and let sit until dry and cool enough to handle. Slice in half lengthwise and place on a rimmed baking sheet. Meanwhile, toast 1 tablespoon sesame seeds in a dry small skillet over medium, stirring occasionally until deep golden brown, 5 to 7 minutes. Transfer to a mortar and pestle and let cool. Coarsely crush sesame seeds. Alternatively, you can smash with the side of a chef's knife or with a heavy skillet. Stir together garlic, mayonnaise, lemon zest, lemon juice, soy sauce, pepper, sugar, sesame oil, 1/2 teaspoon Diamond Crystal or 1/4 teaspoon Morton Kosher salt, and crushed sesame seeds in a small bowl. Prepare grill for medium-high heat. Drizzle olive oil over sweet potatoes, season with salt, and turn to coat. Grill, cut sides down, until deeply charred underneath, 8 to 10 minutes. Transfer sweet potatoes to a platter, arranging cut sides up. Using a fork, lightly crush. Spoon dressing over and top with sesame seeds and scallions. Thanks so much for listening to this on-demand episode of Bon Appetit on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Saying goodbye for now, this is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward.